This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
And I'd like to introduce you to today's guest. Her name is Rebecca Goldberg. Rebecca is a consultant, a Washington Post contributor, and she is the author of The Lean Anthology, a practical primer in continual improvement. And we're going to get to her book, The Lean Anthology, because she's going to have to explain a little bit of it to me. However, before we do that, let me say welcome, Rebecca Goldberg, to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Pamela. I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I am delighted to have you, and you come on wearing a few different hats. And so I'd like to start off with your life in September of 2002. What was going on in 2002, September?
Absolutely. So I was just entering my second year of an MBA program at the Darden School, the University of Virginia. And I was 5.5 months pregnant with my first child, and I was getting married.
You were busy.
I got married to the father of my child.
Okay.
We're living together in a house close to the University of Virginia, and it was a pretty stressful year, I'll say. Getting through the pregnancy, getting through the second year of a very, very rigorous program, actually. Sometimes jokingly called the boot camp of all business schools because it's really high on the workload, but also has just a great student experience. So it was a wonderful program. It was a difficult year. Got through it with the help of many people, great faculty at UVA, and had my first child in February, so before graduating.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I always knew I wanted to be a consultant. I love Sherlock Holmes. I love kind of going in and finding the problem and really perfecting the process. And that's just something that I've always loved. And it's really fed into my life and career choices. So graduating from business school with, an MBA from a top program, I also really, really wanted to be there for my children. I knew I wanted more than one child. And, my child was born small, so he had some health issues off the bat, and I just really wanted to be there for him.
When he was born,
yeah. So I chose to stay home and not go straight into the workforce like so many of my colleagues.
What was his birth weight?
His birth weight was actually 8 pounds, but he had fetal distress. I had a undiagnosed eclampsia and an emergency C-section, and for whatever combination of reasons, he lost weight very quickly.
Wow.
So he sort of settled down into the first percentile, and he's been tracking that growth curve ever since.
So that was a wonderful time. You were married, you were finishing school, you had your first child, but also a scary time.
It was, and I had good people around me, but also, when you're going through something too with a child and, not necessarily working, at home, it can be very isolating. You don't necessarily have all the support around you that you want, so you can feel also isolated.
Well, in a first year of marriage, the theory is that the first year is wonderful, and now you've got a child, and that's wonderful, and you've graduated from school, and that's wonderful. So it kind of sounds like you were launched for the perfect life. Is that what happened?
I wanted that to be what happened, but, life is what happens when you're busy making plans. My husband worked out of town during the week, so he was starting a family business in Richmond. So he was working with his family on the properties here that they had purchased, and he had a single-family home in Richmond that he had purchased, and it was really under renovation and not yet suitable for his wife and child. So really for the first year and a half of my marriage, he didn't live with us during the week. So he would come home on the weekends. And so that was difficult too,
of course,
right off the bat. Yeah.
Now, at this point, you're a year and a half into your marriage. You've got your degree, but you're staying home with your child. At what point did things change, if they changed?
So it was right about at that year and a half mark. I kind of put my foot down and said, if the house isn't ready now, I don't care. We're moving to Richmond. And because I was still outside of Charlottesville, actually on Afton Mountain. So on a mountain, too, which was great and wonderful and beautiful and, you know, wonderful with a young baby. But I was lonely. So I.
And you were on a mountain in Virginia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I said, hey, you know, we're coming to Richmond. If we're going to be married, if, you know, we're going to do this, you know, we need to be together. Like, this is enough. So I went ahead and just sort of showed up one weekend. I don't know if, you know, maybe I said that and then 2 weeks later, everything was moved, you know, but, you know, we did move in. And of course, there were some adjustments that had to happen to the property we were in for me to, you know, be comfortable there with a child. And then shortly thereafter, I became pregnant with our second child. So, you know, at that point, I really did feel economically dependent. And so even though I'm extremely, you know, well-read and well-educated, and I had worked my entire life really on school. I mean, I loved school. I love learning. I love education. I went to business school, not necessarily because I wanted to go run off and be an investment banker and make, you know, tons of money. It was because I really am interested in business. And, you know, I
how many women were in your class with you?
How many women?
Yeah. Was it well populated between men and women?
So there were four sections of about 60. So it was 240 people were in my class at Darden. Several years after that, they changed it and they added a section or two. So now their classes are bigger, but fairly small. And I think the women were, I don't want to misspeak here, but I think perhaps 40%. I mean, very good.
Okay.
UVA is very, very good at making sure that they have a very diverse population, including internationals and everything else.
All right, but now you're in Richmond, and now you're having your second child. I don't know how well it bodes for a marriage that you had to put your foot down and say, I'm moving here, we're moving here, versus there being a mutual agreement almost from day one that you would be there. How did things go with the marriage?
I mean, it was difficult from the very start. You know, and I think the more entrenched you get in a marriage, the more time you spend in the marriage, the more children you have, the longer as a woman that you're out of the workforce. You know, and I didn't go through the whole MBA recruiting process because, you know, our intent was that I would slowly, you know, work up from part-time to full-time, as I did, just under a much more difficult circumstances than I planned. It's hard to answer that question because, of course, I didn't know what it would be like, and no one ever promised me a rose garden. I mean, you expect to work on relationships, but in hindsight, there were very clear signs that I did not heed, and maybe I should have. But then again, how can you ever go back and say, I shouldn't have had my children? I mean, you can't.
No,
but I did at that point feel very trapped, and after I had my second child, was very close to just taking both of them and going to my parents' house. So,
wow. That would have been a big decision. Did you do that?
I didn't. And again, in part because of health issues. So my second child had a blood condition, a blood infection, like a septic condition, and severe jaundice. Severe. In fact, the highest case of jaundice that the hospital had ever seen.
Oh my.
And we spent, it feels like a month in the PICU, the pediatric ICU. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult, and you know, then he needed care to you know, monitor his iron levels and everything else and his blood count for about a year afterwards. And so it was just too much. I mean, I did feel like I was had to stay in the situation, even though it was increasingly difficult for me to stay.
Well, you know,
as my children needed me to.
As you describe what was going on with your children, I mean, there are any number of people probably listening as we speak who have been there, you know, kind of been there, done that. They've had the child or the children. Perhaps the relationship hasn't been what they had hoped, but they have felt that they had no choice. And they have stayed for just tons of reasons. But certainly if you've got two young children, both of whom have not had the best of health sort of coming into the world, I'm not sure that the idea of leaving is would be such an easy thing for anyone. What did you ultimately do? Did you stay in the marriage? What happened?
Well, the problems in the marriage continued and got worse, and the distance between us was more significant. And I think, you know, sometimes you do things without being conscious of it until you've done them. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah,
but
it's true.
I think what I did was, consciously or not, wait until I felt like both of my children could get along well enough together so as not to hurt one another. I mean, young children do odd things. And wait until they were old enough to essentially have, you know, the wherewithal not to do really stupid things like burn themselves or cut themselves or run out into the street. I mean, all the things that, you know, as a mother, you know, you worry about. And so I think I waited until, A, it was intolerable, and B, I knew that even if it was difficult, my children would survive if I wasn't with them. And it just got to that point when my youngest was 2.5 and then my oldest was around 5. I think, like, the air just cleared, my head cleared, and I knew that no matter, you know, how the custody dice fell when I rolled them, they would be alive. You know what I mean? And I don't know how else to say that. I mean, that sounds a little odd. I'm sure maybe other women make other choices, but for whatever reason, I felt okay enough at that point in time to kind of move ahead with discussing separation.
Well, you know, it sounds like a really difficult decision to make. You had two children, and you were married to their dad. And for a lot of women, for a lot of people, the idea of potentially separating the children from either parent would be a really difficult one. And I certainly know that there are situations, there are marriages where people have chosen to stay until the children are in college or married because of the sense that, you know, a parent is better than no parent. And I'm not sure that that's always the case. Sometimes it, in fact, is not the case. And for you, it was not the case. You chose to end that relationship.
I could not have stayed another minute. It was that unfulfilling. But I probably could have left earlier than I thought I could have. So,
well,
I mean,
again,
that day
yeah.
when, you know, Wyatt finally came home from the hospital, you know, could I have taken both the kids and left for my parents? Probably. Could I have worked out the health care? Probably. I mean, it would have been an extreme stress on me. I mean, I had just had my second C-section. So I came back from the hospital having, you know, slept on a cot yeah. postpartum and post-surgery, you know, trying to breastfeed a child that was, you know, under lights night and day.
Right.
It was really, really, really traumatic, and I just couldn't handle it.
Now,
I think sometimes it's just a matter of staging and sequencing and waiting until you have the strength to do it.
Staging and sequencing, I think that's going to be a couple of words that we will come back to a little bit later on in our conversation. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Rebecca, and we will be right back. And when we come back, I'd like to pick up, Rebecca, with what your first steps were as you ended your participation in that marriage, but now you've got two young children. Folks, we'll be right back. We are back. This is Pamela Brewer, continuing the conversation with Rebecca Goldberg. And Rebecca Goldberg is the author of The Lean Anthology, a practical primer in continual improvement. Rebecca, at the point that you ended your participation in the marriage, you had two children. Were you working part-time at that point, or did you have to begin the process of looking for work?
I had to begin the process of looking for work. My divorce agreement was fairly unfavorable financially, which I agreed to because my ex-husband agreed to a slightly more favorable custody agreement. So I essentially agreed to something that left me unfairly without funds so that I could maintain, I don't know how else to say this, but I'm a business person, a controlling stake in my children's lives. And, you know, to make sure that I would be the one who was there kind of managing their education and their healthcare, and that I had enough time to do that. So it was difficult because not only had I been a stay-at-home mom for 6 years by that point, I really hadn't done much work. And it was 2007, 2008, and, you know, huge recession. And several of the larger corporations in Richmond had just suffered through massive rounds of layoffs. Wachovia had left town. Circuit City had just closed. So the market was flooded with people whose resumes were far more relevant than mine. You know, yes, I had a MBA from a top 10 school, but I hadn't worked ever really using that degree. I had done some part-time work at the Darden School, which was very gracious of a couple of my mentors there to involved me in some administrative projects there. So I had something, I could speak to something, but it was really just, you know, projects here and there. So it was fairly difficult. I don't need to go into the financial details, but my house had a lot of problems as well. And so many people said to me, why don't you sell the house and get an apartment? Well, by this point, my oldest child had several learning issues, and I really wanted to keep him in the elementary school that he was in because it's one of the better ones here. And they're just, there's only one apartment complex in this school district. So, I mean, it, you know, and I see what happens to women who lose their houses. So I was just, I was not going to lose my house, and it just didn't matter what it took. I was going to put the left foot in front of the right and the right foot in front of the left and find a way to make a living and keep my house and take care of my children.
And that's what you did.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, there are certainly women who are have been where you were and have really had a challenge in terms of taking the position that you just articulated. I'm going to put one foot in front of the other and I'm just going to make it work. There are many, many women who do precisely what you did, just in terms of how they think about themselves. But for those who might be listening, who might really be overwhelmed, and quite frankly, 6 years stay-at-home mom, two children, both with some challenges, a house that's not in the best of shape, It's easy to be so overwhelmed that you don't move. What would you say to folks who may be in that situation right now?
It will change. Mm. I think some things take longer to change than others. I mean, it really was 2 years, I think, before there wasn't some part of the day that just paralyzed me.
Mm.
And I think that, I guess I don't want to jump too quickly to talking about my book or talking about my consultancy, but it was working with, again, some of the very generous mentors and clients and the faculty at the Darden School at UVA over the years that some people suggested, you know, hey, you know, what about this operations principle? And hey, what about that operations principle? And I started actually slowly employing them in my personal life, sort of these same efficiency principles that sort of the Japanese auto manufacturers use, the Toyota production system, and sort of some of the Lean and Six Sigma principles that I always really loved because I'm a process person, right? You know, people saying, hey, have you heard of the, you know, critical path? Could you apply the concept of critical path to how you get the kids out the door in the morning?
Hmm.
And so that kind of helped me. It sort of neutralized the emotion of it all.
Interesting.
And, you know, it's numbers, right? It's numbers, it's process. It's not necessarily just wallowing in, you know, how it is that you feel. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, it's getting it done. You got something to do and you're going to get it done. That's
yes,
what it sounds
and,
like.
And finding a way to separate the emotional healing from what you actually must accomplish that day. Because, you know, you also see it can be very, very difficult for women when you do have a situation like this where you're economically disadvantaged, you haven't worked in a while, you're trying to get things going, and you have, I mean, in my case, 95% of the bulk of parenting. I do.
Okay.
And finding the time to get all that done is exhausting. And so sometimes it's these process principles and finding ways to use your own time better and more wisely can just help you find that 5 minutes or that 15 minutes of white space that you need to really engage in the emotional healing. So it's not to say, you know, forget about how you feel, just work harder. No, it's about what can you do to restructure how you use your time and your energy in the same ways that businesses do, so that you free up more time for the things that matter to you, like playing on the floor time with your children.
So walk us through, because you've used some terms, and I and many of the listeners are kind of scratching their heads.
Oh, sure.
You've said operations principles, and where some of us are going, okay, what's that? And you're saying Lean Six, and we're like, okay, what's that? So operations principles and getting your children out of the house more in a more useful way. How do those two things connect up?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. So my favorite two subjects when I was in business school were operations management, which is essentially all of the concepts and principles that you would need to know as a manager to essentially run a production facility or to design process that helps you deliver what it is you've promised to your customers.
Okay, no matter what that is.
That is what, yeah. I'm
okay.
Sorry, what's the question?
It could be a book or it could be shoes or it could be houses. No matter what the thing is that you're delivering, these are the processes that you would use to make that an effective delivery. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and not just objects, but services as well.
I
so
see.
In
okay.
any service profession like food service or professional services, you could also use these same concepts, and people do.
So walk us through business principles applied to getting the kids out of the house in the morning.
Okay. So one concept that I thought was really interesting is the concept of critical path. So the critical path is end-to-end the absolutely essential activities that must be done for a process to be considered successful.
Okay.
And any activities that you might engage in that don't contribute to the critical path aren't critical. So if you spend time improving a process that doesn't help you, let's say, get the kids out the door in the morning,
okay,
you didn't shorten the time that the critical path takes.
Okay.
So let's say you measure end to end how long it takes you to get the kids out the door in the morning. And
right, let's say it takes
an
me
an hour.
Okay, great. An hour. All right.
It's an hour, right? And you map out all of those things. You know, you observe the process. You write down what is the current state. You know, okay, we rub our eyes for 5 minutes, and then we, you know, eat breakfast, and that takes 15 minutes. And then, you know, we look around for our shoes and our coats, and that takes 10 minutes. And then we realize that we've forgotten to pack up our homework, and that's another five, something like that, right?
So every single piece of what happens, you actually physically write it down?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you observe and record what is the process. And then you look and you see which pieces of that process are absolutely necessary and must be done in the morning, and which aren't, right? So you could be laying out your shoes the night before. You could be packing the lunches the night before, right? You can't eat breakfast the night before, you know?
Gotcha.
You can lay out your shoes
okay.
the night before, but you can't put them on the night before.
Gotcha,
right?
Okay.
So the critical path is where you separate the activities that aren't part of what actually has to happen at that time from the activities that do have to happen at that time.
And what I hear is you're just going through almost exquisite detail.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So now I've got my list of all the things that happened that cost me an hour in the morning. And I have figured out some things that I might be able to do the night before. Now what?
So now you would want to know what the definition of waste is. Because a big part of Lean or Six Sigma, which are these sort of schools of thought that teach businesses and corporations and process engineers and in production facilities, they'll apply these systems of thought to essentially improve a particular process, right?
Okay.
So you would take these forms of waste, and there are 8 forms of waste, and I will read them to you.
Okay.
There's transportation, excess inventory, motion, waiting, overproduction, overprocessing, mistakes, and untapped creativity or human potential.
Interesting.
Yes. So what you would do is take each of the items on the critical path, and you would figure out which part of this has an element of waste to it that I can remove. And any time you spend improving activities on the critical path will shorten the critical path.
Okay.
So it can reduce the amount of time it takes. But any time you spend improving activities that are not on the critical path has no effect.
Gotcha.
So that's why it's so important to separate what's critical from what's not. Because if you spend time trying to improve something that's not on that critical path, you're not going to shorten the total time that it takes.
You're actually wasting time.
You're wasting time because you're spending time improving something that really doesn't matter.
Okay.
So, yes, it does seem like a stretch initially to say, okay, hey, let's take the techniques that you would use to lean out a factory. You know, that's sort of the lingo. Let's lean out this process, right? It means eliminating one of those 8 forms of waste.
Okay.
Or more. But actually, you know, it's interesting. You really can use very everyday stories to everyday activities and apply these concepts to those everyday activities to get more time for yourself by gaining efficiency. So I'd also like to say we talked about the concept of critical path, but there's another concept that's part of what I did with our morning routine that's called the value stream map.
Okay.
And so when we talked about observing the current state of the process in detail and writing down in detail each piece of it, you can also look at the process end to end and say what part of this adds value and which does not. So when you hear about the value stream map, you see it helps you identify end to end what the entire process is and figure out what needs to be there and what doesn't. So
how is that different? I'm wanting to understand how taking a look at what you're doing that's useful and not is different from critical path. Oh, I get it. Critical path is the stuff that you absolutely have to do. And value stream mapping is taking a look at the whole process. Is that what we're doing?
Yes. And it also helps you say, let's divide what has to be here and what doesn't have to be here.
Okay.
So the critical path is just the concept to say that it's the amount of time required to perform a given task.
Okay.
So if you improve activities on the critical path, you can reduce the completion time of the whole task. But if you improve activities that aren't on the critical path, you're not improving the time it takes, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The value stream map is basically a technique to help you decide what here, which pieces of this process have value, in other words, contribute to the end result, and which don't.
Okay.
So they're related.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And so, again, walk us through that work that you did and how you changed your morning routine with the children.
Sure. So I did sort of touch on some of it. One piece is, because of course the morning, I mean, who wants to be running around doing things at the last minute in the morning?
Exactly. So nobody.
Nobody. So really, you know, you feel like your entire day is depending on one little piece of Velcro or plastic that's missing, you know, like a shoe or,
absolutely,
you know, a bag or like the three-ring binder's broken. So a piece of it is just saying, hey, what can we do the night before when, you know, our energy level might be lower, but we can prep for the next day. And another important piece I'd say about what it was, or what the benefit was of doing this, was that we did it together. So it wasn't me observing the process and me saying, here's how it is, boys, here's how we need to make it better. It was a way for me to engage the kids in helping to redesign their own process. And that's also a really, really important part of Lean as it's applied in a business setting, is employee education, employee engagement, helping people learn the tools to take control of their own process improvement.
Gotcha.
So that was a big piece of it, was that it was something that instead of me then getting angry and them crying, right? So that's always bad, getting your morning off on a bad start, is, you know, walking them through, okay, let's write down everything we do on an index card and figure out how much time it takes, and engaging them in doing it. So, I mean, it was just little things, right? Little things that, you know, okay, let me do the dishes the night before because, you know, I'm doing the dishes while they're eating breakfast and I can't hear them because the water's going.
Okay.
And then I miss what it is they wanted to tell me about their day. Or, you know, let's do the socks a different way. So now always the socks and the shoes are in a basket by the front door. So it's, you know, by going through the process and figuring out, where is it that I'm missing things? Where am I taking more time or using more energy than I need to? And then we got it down from 55 minutes to 35 minutes.
Wow.
Well, then they have 20 minutes to either sleep, or now actually we use that time to read. Because I think usually when they get home from school, they don't really, they want to go play with the neighborhood kids.
Right.
They have
a
lot of homework. So me telling them to go read their book for an hour, that's not happening.
Gotcha.
But in the morning, when we have an extra 20 minutes, I read them a chapter of a book, or one of my children reads the chapter of the book. And so that's another piece of Lean is, well, what do you do with that extra time once you have it? And so that's what we did with it.
And, you know, what's really exciting, I mean, your children on some levels, I mean, they were old enough, but they were still very young. And you engage them at a very early age in observing their own behavior and understanding that they can have an impact on their own behavior and they can have an impact on their own lives, and teaching them about teamwork and collaboration.
Yes, that is true. And I did that in different ways. There are actually several stories modeled off of these moments about them and me interacting with them in the book. And again, it's not about, you know, particularly thinking through, you know, economic independence, recovering from divorce, figuring out how to make it all work when, you know, all of a sudden you have all these additional demands and you have to, you know, I think of it as like killing a buffalo and dragging it back to the cave every day. I mean, I have to put food on the table too. So when you're struggling with all that, I think, at least for me, the key is to separate when is it my time to heal and take care of myself, and separating that from just getting really good at getting things done, and engaging them in that process, just like you would do in a lean transformation in a factory or a production facility. It works at home too.
You tell the story in your book of Donna. Donna was a stay-at-home mom, and she started making jewelry. Woman after my own heart. Talk about that story.
Yes. So the story about Donna, it's another lean concept, and it has to do with the theory of constraints. So the again, you would maybe map your process. So Donna has a jewelry making business, and she realizes that, you know, she just can't keep everything together. She's got all these orders. You know, she had an article, I think, featured in a local magazine, and you know, she has all these orders for weddings or something. And so all of a sudden her production has to go up, and she just can't do it, right? She's bursting at the seams. She has way too much to do. And so what she needs to do is think through, well, what is my bottleneck? What are my constraints? And what is the part of this process that's moving the slowest? And then how do I alleviate that bottleneck? How do I create more capacity at that place in the system so that my throughput can increase? And so I think what she did is explore outsourcing some of the piecework that she was doing, because she realized that that was what was holding her back.
So in outsourcing, what she was able to do was to hire people to do some of the parts of the work, which then freed her up to do the things that only she could do.
That's correct. Yes, yes.
Now, you also talk about one doing a current state analysis. Is that kind of the same thing as the value stream mapping, or is that different as well?
Well, it can be. So a current state analysis is any essentially record or very detailed observation of a current process. And you can do that in the form of a value stream, or you can just write down what it is that you're doing.
Okay.
So so Todd, for instance, there's a story in the book about Todd. And he never has enough energy at the end of the day to play with his children. And it's painful to him. And his wife is, you know, very supportive. They have a happy family and a good marriage. But he feels like that's a real defect in his day. He doesn't know how to get out of it. He feels like he's 9 to 5. He has a management role. And what they did was they essentially observed in detail what he did at what time of day. So that would be a current state analysis.
Okay.
And then they used the principles of lean to improve the way that he, you know, they moved things around. You know, he commuted at a different time, so he was driving less. He was sleeping more. You know, he went to the gym at lunch, that kind of thing. But they applied a sort of a rigorous lean, a lean look at his day. And they freed up, you know, I think a good hour of time at the end of the day for him to play with the kids and spend time with the kids. And not only that, he had more energy when he did. He wasn't as tired. And it was because of the way he arranged his day.
So this, excuse me, the lean anthology is actually a series of vignettes, if you will, with people in different walks of life engaging in different sort of business ventures and looking at the ways in which they applied the lean principles to enhance their productivity. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. The idea that you as a woman, now you've gone from being a stay-at-home mom for 6 years with two children and two children who had some challenges. Now you're divorced or separated. And we're talking about business concepts and the lean and all. How did that happen? How did that transition happen? I understand that you had mentors, But was there something within you that helped you go from that person 6 years at home to the person now who's co-author of a book, writer for the Washington Post, and has, quite frankly, a pretty impressive client list?
Well, thank you very much. I will start off by saying a lot of work. I mean, it's a lot of work being an entrepreneur. I mean, I'm a sole practitioner, so, you know, I don't have employees in the typical sense, but just a lot of work. And I am divorced. This is actually my 8th year taking care of the children alone. And I have just learned so much about survival, I think. So just continually knocking on doors, continually looking for work, taking on challenges. Last year, I had several consulting assignments that were applied. You know, I was doing less writing about areas where I have subject matter expertise and doing more work where I was going into companies and applying that. So I've been doing that for several years now. And, you know, it's funny, I thought I would have performance anxiety. You know, I thought I would go in and feel like sort of imposter syndrome, and I didn't. Not one day. I got in and I thought, oh, let's do this, and I did it. I think that's just happened because I just never took no for an answer.
Okay.
And I just kept going, kept going, kept going.
Folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, one of the comments, Rebecca, that you have made is that while women are naturally good at logistics and management of complex systems, there are few women in the U.S. managing production facilities. So when we come back, I'd like to pick up there and get your sense of why that is and if that needs to be different. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we'll be right back. Rebecca, you, as I said a few moments ago, you say that women are naturally good at logistics and management of complex systems, but not a whole lot of women in the United States managing production facilities. What's your sense of what that's about?
Well, I've taken a look at some of the statistics, and I know actually that NPR did a pretty big story on this several weeks ago, so it's quite timely. But depending on where you look, I think between 17% and 20% of manufacturing positions are filled by women. And I wasn't able to find an exact statistic, but I'd venture to say that they're very underrepresented in management positions in manufacturing. And, you know, women are such a large proportion of our workforce. Mm-hmm. We have so many advanced degrees. We've made so many strides, particularly in this country, in you know, occupying positions of authority. And still, I've done a lot of touring of different production facilities through the work that I've done creating MBA course materials at the University of Virginia and in my work for corporations. And I don't often see, you know, I'm not often greeted at the door by a woman. And I very rarely see them as I'm sort of walking around the shop floor and taking a look at, you know, all the amazing layouts and looking at the machines and everything, which I love. And I just think it's a disconnect. I always thought that operations and process engineering was such an interesting interesting way to go. It was an interesting subject to explore. And I think a lot of it has to do with perhaps the equations. You know, it's sort of intimidating perhaps to some women. Maybe they don't relate to the equations as easily as the men do. I don't know.
Okay.
That's just a guess. But part of what this book does also is it's intended to be, it essentially takes almost all of the concepts that anyone would learn in a first year MBA program operations management course. Certainly all of the concepts you'd get in an undergraduate business course in operations, and all of the concepts that you would need at a corporate university to support learning of lean concepts to support a lean transformation, which is what it's usually called in a corporate setting. And it uses these everyday stories to teach those skills in, you know, language that anyone, but I think particularly women, can more easily relate to. So for people who don't have that traditional manufacturing background, they don't have an engineering background, maybe equations are a little scary or they just don't take as naturally to them, this is a great way to fill that gap.
When you talk about your experience of rarely being met at the door by a woman, how are you treated? How have you been received by the men who meet you at the door? Your name is Rebecca, so they're not expecting a guy, but how do they treat you?
Oh, with so much respect. I mean, you know, how can you categorize a particular profession? But I think operations management professors and people in operations management really respect it when a woman walks through the door and knows what she's talking about. So I don't feel at all like I'm trying to tread in a old boys network. I really don't.
You don't. That's interesting.
There may be some professions where women do have that feel, but I never have.
That's interesting. There's another story in your book where you talk about a coffee shop, and you kind of take the reader through how the owner of that coffee shop made his product more successful than it perhaps might have been. Can you talk about that? Theron, I'm not sure how you pronounce the name of that coffee shop.
Yes, sure. So this is a concept, and again, there's like 17 stories in the book, and they're organized into a framework that's really easy to understand. The particular story I think you're talking about has to do with the two different lines. So there's a distinction in operations management called make-to-order versus make-to-stock.
Okay.
And make-to-order means it takes more time, right? The line gets longer. So there's one line where everybody wants, you know, a custom specialty brewed cup of coffee. You know, they want to pour over. They get to choose from, like, 30 different organic varieties. The line is super long. And, you know, people are willing to wait because, you know, they want that customized make-to-order cup. They're willing to wait. They want it fresh. And then there's the other line, which is a make-to-stock line, which is sort of, you know, you'd see in Starbucks or any other coffee shop. You usually have two or three vats of coffee that are already made, so
right. They're
easy to fill.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, for in that one, the lean, walk us through how that coffee shop owner restructured his business.
I'm not sure how he restructured his business. I think that what he was doing was deciding is this the order-winning criteria? Because I talk about Theron. Okay. So what he did there was he made a decision to speak to the order-winning criteria of his customers. So part of lean has to do with, you know, just as when you're kind of making decisions about the critical path, you know, what's critical path here and what's not? What do we need to spend time on? And what, if we spend time on it, really isn't going to add to the result that we want?
Mm.
Another piece of lean is being able to figure out what is it that your customers want and listening to the voice of the customer and saying, you know, if the customer's asking for two things, you know, they're asking for a quick cup of coffee because they're walking in, they're walking out, they want something good, they want it to be consistent, and they want to be on their way. And then some of the customers are saying, hey, we want to linger, we'd like more selection. You know, I think what Theron did is he really listened to what is it that my customer wants, and then he designed a process that spoke to that.
You know, one of the things that I gets lost sometimes in businesses of any kind is what the customer wants. I suspect that there are times when the owner of the business or the manager of the business gets more caught up in what he or she thinks the customer should want versus finding out from the customer what they actually want.
Yes, and I think the larger the company gets, and the more entrenched it gets. I mean, the classic example is IBM. There's a famous book called Elephants Can't Dance, or Why Can't Elephants Dance, or something, and it's about that. You know, the more entrenched you get in a particular product or technology or some idea of what people should want, I think the more out of touch you can get with what the current environment is actually calling for. And so strategy and operations and marketing is all really a dance where you're continually adjusting and you're out there and you're not just, there's a difference between observation and conversation, right? You can observe your customers or you can converse with them and you can actually find out, you know, you can sort of read the sea changes and pick up on the nuances of, you know, is the basketball that I'm bouncing going to be on a different court tomorrow? And if so, how do I need to be thinking about the processes that I already have so that my definition of a lean process or a good process is able to deliver what people want?
You know, I think that there are some folks who might find actually talking to the customer, listening to the customer as really kind of scary because you run the risk of the customer telling you what you don't want to hear.
That's true. That's very true.
So for those folks who are saying, they're there now, I know better than the customer what the customer wants. For those folks who say, I know better than the customer what the customer wants, are those people whose businesses will ultimately be obsolete?
Well, it depends on how big the company is.
Okay.
As to how long it will take.
Okay.
But certainly, I mean, the best businesses are the ones that are a little more nimble. They're the ones that are able to respond and react when what the market is calling for is going to change. But I think you did hit on something quite interesting when you said that, you know, I mean, and I think this is true in psychology too, or in someone's personal life, kind of to bring it back to the personal element. We don't always want to see what's in front of our faces, right? Whether it's that our children aren't getting what they need, that we're not emotionally getting what we need out of our marriage, that we need to be doing something different. You know, it's not just how I get myself out the door in the morning, but what I'm doing that needs to change or how I'm thinking. I mean, a big part of lean is transparency, right? And recording things as they are and looking at them with people who otherwise might disagree, might have very political disagreements. And just neutralizing it and saying, hey, this is about data. This is about facts.
Uh-huh.
And there's, you know, we can look at the facts and do something about it, or we can ignore it. And, I think when companies do ignore it, they ultimately do have, I mean, that, you know, not to be grandiose, but that might be the biggest problem in why companies do fail is that they really have lost touch with embracing transparency and being able to look collectively at what is instead of what they want it to be or wish it was.
Gotcha.
Score.
you describe your Twitter platform as really being an extension of what you are so passionate about, which is educating women in fundamental business management skills. How popular is your Twitter platform?
Well, I have around 7,000 followers, which
wow.
is, you know, good for an individual person. And you know, I mean, I'm just sort of haven't really peaked in my career, right? This is my first book. You know, I've written a couple dozen articles in major publications, but, you know, I'm still on an upward trajectory, so I feel pretty good about the 7,000. And I have graciously been included in sort of a retweet network of women who were really, really involved in promoting economic literacy worldwide.
Mm.
And for me, it's not just for women, it's for everyone, because I just very, very strongly believe that the concepts that we learn in business school, whether they're operations management concepts or their strategy concepts or marketing concepts, can really help people negotiate better, navigate life better, know when it's time to leave, right? When it's time to hold your cards and when it's time to fold them and move on.
Gotcha.
And how to really, you know, embrace our power and be able to earn a living and put the skills that we have together in a way that makes sense for us.
So in fact, what you're saying, and I think what we've been talking about, as we've been talking about your personal life, as well as the book that you've co-written, The Lean Anthology, is that there really is a way to take a look at what's going on in your life right now and give it a critical look, that critical not meaning negative, but careful, and make some changes that can actually enhance your productivity and the quality of your life, whatever that life is that you're living.
Yes, yes, I think so. And with a lean transformation in organizations that really do embrace sort of the concepts of lean down to the level of employee engagement, which is where my heart is, you know, giving people a common vocabulary so they can talk about their own process and improve their own process together. You often, in those situations, particularly if I've like followed or done research, field research with a company over several years or many years even, you often really see those employees saying, hey, this bled into my personal life. You know, mm-hmm. this changed how I related to my family. You know, this changed how I felt about my children. And it becomes very emotional because it's a very powerful tool. I think it can go the other way too, right? So if you take a couple of the concepts from this book and you apply them to your personal life and you say, hey, you know, I just gave myself 20 more minutes in the morning and I used it to meditate or to pray or to read a book to my child or, you know, to take a run, you know, those things, those changes, those very, very small changes, they compound. And they allow you over time, it's work, right, to see your day in a different way. And I think that it can go the other way and that those changes can also bleed into your professional life. And, you know, as you use those techniques in the different settings that you have available to you, I think you, you know, I think it was Stephen Covey who brought initially the concept of your sphere of influence or your sphere of power.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that this is how you do it. This is how you sharpen the sword. This is how you expand what it is that you have the ability to do in your life.
Folks, you've been listening to Rebecca Goldberg, who is the co-author with Elliot Weiss of The Lean Anthology, A Practical Primer in Continual Improvement. Rebecca, is there a website or a Twitter handle that you would like to share with folks?
Sure. My website is goldbergstrategic.com, and my Twitter handle is at Rebecca Goldberg, and the L in Goldberg is the number one.
Okay, got it. Thank you very much, Rebecca. It's been delightful talking with you today.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
All righty. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, send me an email to Pamela at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.ORG. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.